This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Former Baptist Minister Mark Walker pulled off an upset this week, defeating Rockingham County District Attorney Phil Berger Jr. in the Republican primary in the 6th Congressional District. That was a runoff race. Berger lost despite high-level political connections and an endorsement from the incumbent, the beloved Howard Coble, who held that seat since 1985. The upset raises questions about how Republican candidates will fare in the general election. All that, plus Republican Representative Renee Elmers made remarks about women this week that sparked a controversy. Political junkie Ken Rudin joins us now to talk about that and more. Welcome, Ken.
Thanks a lot, Frank.
Tell us about your reaction to this Walker-Berger race.
Well, I'm of two minds, as John Kerry would like to say. First of all, the thought of Berger losing was really not considered for the longest time. As you say, he's a son of Phil Berger Sr., the Senate president, who has tremendous connections. Berger had tons of money, and he was the all-but-anointed nominee to succeed Howard Coble. But I think that was part of the problem. He felt he ran as the anointed candidate. He didn't run as somebody who seemed to really want to be in Congress. He just felt like he deserved it. And whatever you think of Mark Walker, and Mark Walker was certainly far more conservative than Berger on a host of issues. His rhetoric was certainly much more a red meat rhetoric. Walker seemed more genuine candidate. So while Berger had the endorsements and the money and the establishment behind him, Walker had the energy.
Here's the thing. It was a bruising battle. That was the runoff. The initial race included some nine candidates or more, a lot of negative campaign ads, so that when Berger had to make his concession speech, here's what he says.
Let me at this point say congratulations to my opponent, Mark Walker. I would urge everyone to vote Republican in the upcoming election. It is important that we unify as a party behind the Republican nominee.
Okay, you got applause in that room, but a lot of folks say there are so many bent feelings and hurt feelings. Some Republicans might sit it out in the 6th District. What do you think?
Well, you know, we keep talking about this schism in the Republican Party. We see in Mississippi that Thad Cochran ostensibly defeated Chris McDaniel, the Tea Party candidate, in the Republican runoff. But McDaniel has not conceded. He's contesting the results, and he's fighting all the way. So you see in a lot of states that battle between the establishment and the Tea Party wings of the Republican Party continue. When I think of what happened with Berger and Walker, I wonder, the best thing that could have happened to Tom Tillis is that he did not have to go through a similar runoff experience, because it seems like the conservative wing, the Tea Party wing, seems to get more energized as we enter a runoff in states like this.
Well, and you talked about the money, and money didn't seem to matter. You said that Berger had really raised far more money than Walker. Walker proud of the fact that it was kind of a grassroots campaign. Let's listen.
We've made a promise 18 months ago that we would run through the Republican primary and we would not take any special interest, any PAC, any lobbyist money, and we haven't taken a dime.
All right, so can he keep that up through the general election?
Well, the Republicans, I mean, look, the Republicans obviously are favored to continue control of the House. All of the attention seems to be on the battle for the Senate. But they can't take the 6th District for granted, even though it's, Mitt Romney, I think, won it by 17 points in 2012. It's a solid Republican district. Howard Coble, as you pointed out, has held a seat for so many years. But Howard Coble is not Mark Walker, as Lloyd Benson might want to say. You know, I knew Jack Kennedy. But, I mean, Howard Coble was very conservative, but he believed in talking to the other side. He believed in cooperation with Democrats. And while he was, as I say, very, very conservative, he still didn't play that us against them game. And the Democrats could very well point to a lot of Walker's previous statements about a whole slew of things, including women's issues, which seems to be the Democratic theme going into the midterm elections. And it could be a very competitive race. It's a Republican district, but the numbers among Democrats and Republicans are pretty close. It's a conservative district, and that's what Walker's supporters are hoping for. But this is not a slam dunk.
You talked about women's issues. So in other news, Republican Representative Renee Elmers of North Carolina's 2nd Congressional District sparked some controversy last week, for a statement she made in a meeting that was held by the U.S. Conservative Caucus. She was discussing issues facing women, and the controversial statements made it sound like she thought men were generally smarter than women, and men had to talk down to women in order to win. But I want you to hear the entire clip. There actually is a little editing in here, but it's a little bit larger than just the quotes that have been appearing in the media. I do think this puts it in context, but I'll let your ears be the judge. Let's listen to Renee Elmers.
Women, by and large, agree with us on all of the issues. If you go through each issue, they agree. It's how we are able to articulate ourselves, make sure that we're getting the point across that we care before we do anything else, that we relate to them, that we understand what every woman in this country is dealing with. Especially moms, you know, we balance so many different things, you know, or school. Think about what many of you are doing. You know, you're trying to maintain that job, but you want to be moving up in your career. All these different things are playing in at the same time. Men do tend to talk about things on a much higher level. You know, one of the things that has always been one of my frustrations, and I speak about this all the time, many of my male colleagues, when they go to the House floor, they've got, you know, some pie chart or graph behind them, and they're talking about trillions of dollars and, you know, how the debt is awful, and, you know, and we all agree with that. But by starting off that discussion that way, we've already turned people away, because it's like, that doesn't affect my life. I don't understand how that affects my life. The biggest need that women have is more time. We all want more time in our lives. More time in the morning to get ready. More time in the evening to spend time with our families. All of these things. More time to move up that career path. It's about time. And we have to make sure that women understand that. We understand that. We need our male colleagues to understand that if you can bring it down to a woman's level in everything that she is balancing in her life, that's the way to go.
Republican from the 2nd District, Renee Elmers, last week on The State of Things. I'm with political junkie Ken Rudin. Ken, that is a more bad quality audio than I like to play on this show for any length of time, but I do think it puts it in context. I mean, how did you hear that?
Could you play it again? Because I want you to bring it down to my level. If you bring it down to my level, I would understand it better. You know, this, what's so fascinating about this is that we do know about the Republicans' troubles with women. It's not just about abortion. It's about women's rights and contraceptive freedom and availability and things like that. And Renee Elmers is one of the party spokespeople who are designed to go out there and say, look, the Republican Party is not the party of the war on women that the Democrats like to talk about. So when you have somebody like Elmers to talk about, well, you know, these men have this higher level of understanding with these pie charts and all this, bring it down to a women's level. Now, in fairness, I think I understand what she kind of wanted to say, that somehow male legislators need to connect better with women who are concerned about raising family and things like that. But the way she said it, it's just one more part of the arsenal and the Democrats' cache of weaponry against Republican statements about women.
In other news, a Republican.
Wait, there's other news.
There's other news. Republican running for congressman in Arizona gets on the hate bus. Only it turns out that when he snapped a photo of a passing school bus that he thought carried immigrants and he was going to tweet his hate statement, this is not compassion, it is an abrogation of the rule of law, turns out the bus was filled with kids from the Y. Let's hear, first of all, before he knows this, what he says to reporters. His name is Adam Quasman.
I was able to actually see some of the children in the buses, in the fear and on their faces. This is not compassion.
Do you know that was a bus with YMCA kids?
They were sad, too.
They were sad, too. Oh, it is sad, isn't it, Ken? There you go.
Well, you know, it's fascinating. I mean, there is a contingent of the Republican Party that wants to fight what's going on at the border at all costs, and it's absolutely untenable. I mean, for all the arguments President Obama wants to make about changing immigration policy, this influx of tens of thousands of refugees, of people, children, many children, coming in from Central America is just complicating the whole thing. But then when you have somebody running for Congress in a district district where, again, this is a vulnerable Democratic incumbent, Ann Fitzpatrick in Arizona, and she is definitely beatable. And you have a Republican talking about, you know, well, the fear on their faces when actually these kids are going to a YMCA camp. You wonder about the quality of some of the Republicans. And, of course, you know that Frank Stacio, WUNC, and the rest of the liberal media will focus on this stuff. You know, obviously, that's how it works here. But in seriously, though, you have these candidates out there who seem to be taking very winnable seats and come up with these cockamamie conclusions and analyses that just seem to hurt the party over and over and over again. And what's similar about this race is interesting because Quasman is running against Andy Tobin. And the only reason I mentioned that Andy Tobin is the state House Speaker, which is in a very similar situation as Tom Tillis in North Carolina, in that you have ostensibly a vulnerable Democratic incumbent, Kay Hagan, and you have an establishment candidate in Arizona, Andy Tobin, in North Carolina, Tom Tillis. But conservatives keep saying that Tillis and Tobin are just too moderate, they're too establishment. They don't support border militias in the case of Arizona. So,
and keep the white kids out. Keep the white kids out. Listen,
exactly.
I got to be fair to Quasman because he did apologize, and we got to hear it.
I apologize. I didn't know. I was leaving when I saw them. I said, I saw children. Right. I saw children.
But those weren't migrant children.
Those were not migrant children. That's fine.
There we go. Ken,
that's fairness to cause.
That's it. I thought I'd give him a break. We're going to take a break right here. Ken Rudin, political junkie. Find his link to Scuttle Button on our website. We're going to stay with us. Ken's going to join a couple of pollsters, talk about how that business is done as we prepare to hear more and more polls. And you will hear that conversation on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Public polling is an art and a science. Just small changes in wording or methodology could have a dramatic impact on a poll's outcome. And as we gear up for the November midterm election, we will certainly be inundated with polls about important races and issues in our state. So we're going to talk to two polling experts and try to break down political polling. We'll hear about some of their findings in recent polls in North Carolina as well. And political junkie Ken Rudin will stay with us. He will be talking with the director of Democratic-leaning survey firm Public Policy Polling. Tom Jensen is with us. Hello, Tom.
Hey, good to be with you.
Also with us, the assistant director of the Elon University poll, Jason Husser. Hello, Jason.
Howdy.
So, Tom, tell us about PPP. First of all, tell us how you got started.
Well, the impetus of our company being founded was that survey research is very expensive when done by live telephone interviewers. A poll will often cost $20,000, $30,000. And when we were initially founded, it was to give a lower cost polling option to Democratic candidates for smaller offices, things like the legislature, school board, county commissioner, that sort of thing. And the way that our polls are done that's cheaper is that ours are done with automated interviews. You get called up with a recorded voice. Do you approve or disapprove of Barack Obama? If you approve, press 1. If you disapprove, press 2. And that kind of polling costs about a tenth of traditional polling and lets us be a more affordable option.
But the reason not everybody goes to that is, I mean, there is a downside to that kind of polling.
Yeah, you can't go as long in terms of your polls. The polls usually have to be more like 10 or 15 questions than having polls that are like 60, 65 questions. And the other thing that's become increasingly difficult for us in recent years is that automated polls aren't allowed to call cell phones. And to help make up for that, we're now doing 20% of the interviews for our public polls over the internet to reach people who don't have landlines in their homes.
Right. Now, Jason, the Elon poll doesn't use automated polling, so tell us how your surveys work.
So we physically dial manually each number we call, and we have well-trained students who are dialing folks on the phone and saying, hi, I'm a student from Elon University. And then we do go into these, you know, 15-minute, 60, 70-question surveys.
And the fact that you're at an academy does sort of give you, in other words, it's not as expensive to do that kind of research as it would be for a private firm.
It's not as expensive because professors don't make that much money. it's still quite expensive, yeah. Though. Our polls probably cost 10 times as much as Tom's polls. So we can't provide the types of information that Tom provides with PPP. He's able to do things that we just can't do because of budgetary reasons.
Tom, tell us about that, because you do essentially two different kinds of poll. You do public polling about races and issues, but also private polling kind of on assignment, right?
Yeah, we try to be one of the biggest sources in the country of up-to-date polling information on the big Senate races, gubernatorial races across the country for public consumption. So every week we go into one or two states that have close races and we'll do a poll there and look at how's your Senate race going, how's your governor's race going. You know, where's your state on gay marriage these days? What's your favorite sports team? Really broad poll, sort of looking at a bunch of different issues in a particular state. But really the meat of our business and 90% of what we do is private polls for political candidates, interest organizations, businesses, helping them to figure out, how are we going to win this election? How are we going to sell our product? If you're an interest group, what races should we be playing in to try to push our policy agenda forward? So most polling companies sort of fall into either the public polling category, which Elon does an awesome job with, or the commercial polling category. And we're sort of unusual in that we're a hybrid and do both of those things.
You recently have weighed in on the race between Kay Hagan and Tom Tillis. You've done some polling. I think both of you have done that. Right. Jason, tell us what you found.
So we found that Hagan seems to have hit some sort of a floor. So she had been tanking in approval for every poll that we had done for a while, but it seems that that's leveled off. And at this point, it's really about moving the undecideds into her camp versus against her.
Yeah. Well, how about you, Tom?
There's really been fascinating movement in the Senate race over the last year and a half. When we started polling it in early 2013, Kay Hagan was generally up about 5 points on Tom Tillis. The legislature made everybody mad last summer. The Republican candidate's one of the biggest leaders of that legislature. All of a sudden, Hagan's lead shot up to 10 to 15 points, and it's like, maybe this race isn't going to be that competitive. The difficulties with the rollout of Obamacare happened. Republicans started attacking Kay Hagan on TV. That 15-point lead instantly went to zero. And for 6 or 7 months, we were finding month after month, the race is tied, the race is tied, the race is tied. Now with the legislature back in session, we're finding Hagan again with about a 5-point lead that she started out the whole election with a year and a half ago. And what's going to be really interesting to see is whether she can sustain that after the legislature goes home, gets out of the headlines, stops hurting Tom Tillis by association. But right now, for all the twists and turns we've seen in between, this race is about where it was a year and a half ago.
Ken, how do you see this race at this point?
Well, I agree with Tom. I think it is very, very close. I think clearly Kay Hagan is vulnerable. But as everybody seems to be pointing out, Tom Tillis does have his problems, not only with his own party, but the fact that he's trying to run a legislature, a session that's gone much longer than anybody expected and certainly is hurting. And as we saw with the upset of Phil Berger and stuff like that, you know, the walkers of the world are the people who don't like people with legislative experience, don't like people in public office, at least on the Republican side. But the question I have for Tom, though, is, and I've been following the PPP polls, that sounds redundant, but for quite a while, and I'm very impressed with, you know, his numbers and everything, but there is a feeling in the political world that automated polling is just not as reputable, not as reliable, and that seems to be pretty universal in the political journalism way of thinking. Tom, what do you respond to that?
Well, I honestly think, Ken, that that's a very Washington, D.C. viewpoint.
But I live in Potomac, Maryland. I don't live actually in Washington, D.C.
When you look at the actual studies of the accuracy of live interview polls compared to automated polls, it's very comparable in terms of how good they are at calling elections. And in 2012, we were actually the only public polling company in the country to correctly predict the winner of the presidential race in every single swing state. I think that a lot of the media outlets that are sort of fueling the automated polls or second-rate narrative are ones that have their own polls that they commission that are done by live interviewers. So there's sort of a built-in incentive to try to degrade automated polls. I think the way I look at it is there's good polls and there's bad polls, and there's good polls and bad polls within live interview polls, and there's good polls and bad polls within automated polls. There's certainly some automated polls I think are terrible, but there's also some live interview polls that I think are terrible.
Well, and I should point out, Tom, that while Ken says he lives in Potomac, Maryland, that is still inside the Beltway. So technically, he's still in D.C. Well, let me ask you this because – and I'll ask you both this, Jason and Tom. Wording is kind of critical, and I'll start with you, Tom, because you did – particularly on issues, how you phrase the question says everything about how we're going to get an answer. And when you did polling on Amendment 1, mm-hmm. gay marriage amendment, that I think demonstrated how the way you asked the question is going to determine the results.
Yeah, we did a poll and we asked, would you support or oppose an amendment to the North Carolina Constitution prohibiting same-sex couples from getting married or having a civil union? And when you asked it that way, do you think that gay couples should be prohibited from doing that? People said 2-1 that they were against an amendment prohibiting gay couples from having those legal rights. Now, the actual ballot language that the Republicans put on the ballot was, do you support or oppose defining marriage as being between one man and one woman? And when you put it that way, when you just say defining marriage between one man and one woman, that people said they were 2-1 in favor of. And of course, that's pretty much how it ended up going at the polls. So even though those descriptions of what was trying to be done were both accurate and fair indicators of what was going to happen, when you said prohibit, 2-1 against. When you said define, 2-1 for. People just didn't want to sound mean, and defining marriage sounded very innocuous.
So, Jason, politicians know what they want to do when they write language like that and put it on the ballot. But if you're a pollster, you're trying to get at how people really feel about things, issues. What do you do about that language question? Because it seems like any way you put it, it's going to push the answer one way or another.
Well, we try to use questions that have been vetted and pre-tested. So here's an example of something we ran into recently. We were thinking about making some sort of North Carolina happiness index. The standard question for happiness says, in general, how would you say things are going these days? We started calling our friends and family to test this question. They'd say, oh, well, I'm not too happy. And so we were concerned. And what it turned out is they weren't answering about their happiness. They were saying, well, I don't like the president, or the economy's bad. So we did this experiment where you just added in your life to this standard question, and we got drastically different results. All of a sudden, people were much happier. So tiny little wordings can make a huge difference, and the thing is you don't know about them until usually after the fact. So we try to use as standard of questions as possible.
Yeah, Tom, does it change much? I mean, obviously, when you're asking for preferences, who you're going to vote for, it seems to me like that's a pretty straightforward question. Wording may not make such a big difference, right?
Yeah, we try to do that in a very standard way. If the candidates for U.S. Senate this fall were Democrat Kay Hagan, Republican Tom Tillis, and Libertarian Sean Haugh, who would you vote for? We basically try to make it simulate the ballot to the greatest extent possible.
Of course, you remember in the race between Nixon and McGovern, do you remember Lou Harris, Ken, who actually predicted that McGovern was going to win, and he defends to this day, well, not to this day, but to his dying day, that
he's not dead.
He was right that Lou is still with us.
He calls me.
Is he still do you get advice from him? Great poll. The Lou Harris poll was the poll.
I don't know if he still conducts polls, but he lives on Key West, and he calls me every now and then. He'll see one of our polls on TV, and he'll want to have a talk about it. And he's a very delightful man in his 90s.
We should have a poll to see if Lou Harris is still alive. But in fairness
you have
to
a lot
Lou
of
Harris,
adult news.
In fairness to Lou Harris, McGovern did sweep Massachusetts. So let's be honest here.
Well, he was saying that actually, if the race had gone on for another 2 weeks, Jeb, given the trend, you know, it was gonna be okay. That he was absolutely right. But
that was more true about Nixon and Humphrey. If it lasted
Nixon and Humphrey.
Not McGovern.
I've been wrong all day, but that's because I'm in the company of pollsters, so why would I be right?
And you don't live in Potomac.
So let me ask you this, though, Ken. In terms of questions, there's one way that a poll is helpful in the sense that it's in the horse race sense. Who's ahead? Who's winning? Who's losing? But in another way, it seems to me that they, you know, push polls can, and I'll ask you to describe that, can shape the debate. Because if I can frame a question in such a way that makes it sound like an overwhelming majority of North Carolinians are opposed to gay marriage because of the way I put the question, I can then use that on the campaign trail. So there's a way in which polls, they don't just take the temperature, they frame the debate, Ken, would you say?
That's absolutely true, and I think Tom described it a perfect way. A lot has to do with the way a question or a polling question is worded, and you could do it in such a way with push polls that, I mean, you could be for anything the way you write something, and then, of course, a campaign will release, say, well, here's, you know, they're on our side because this poll shows it. I'd love to know what if Eric Cantor ever runs for office again, whether he keeps the same pollster or somebody else, and which leads to another question. There is something, if you poll an entire district and who's going to win, Eric Cantor or David Bratt, the guy who defeated him, and of course Eric Cantor's pollster said that Cantor wins 64-36, but there's a huge difference between likely voters and just polling the district, and that's what I think where Eric Cantor fell so short.
And the fact that, particularly in a midterm election, I guess, and I'll ask the pollsters about this, because voter turnout is so low, you know, again, your margin of error becomes even more critical, right? Jason?
Getting that likely voter model right is in some ways the hardest thing about what we do. There is art and then there's a science to it. As an academic, I try to stay away from the art part. The science is that we will ask a whole bunch of questions that seem to try to predict who's going to turn out to vote and then compare that to things that we know about the electorate.
How often, Tom, do you go back, you know, and come up with a sort of an Amazon-like algorithm that based on the last election and what your polls showed and how things turned out, you sort of adjust the way you ask questions? And does that help you?
Yeah, I mean, when we're trying to project the electorate for something like this fall, we look at a combination of things like who voted in past elections, looking at census data for the state, how's the population shifting, what groups are getting bigger and smaller. But the biggest thing, to some extent, is enthusiasm, what groups are excited and which ones aren't. In 2010, the North Carolina electorate was fundamentally different from what it had looked like in 2008. African Americans didn't turn out at nearly the same rate they had for Obama in 08. Young voters didn't turn out at nearly the same rate. And that's really how Republicans got control of the legislature to some extent, was that the Democratic base didn't turn out in 2010, and then the Republicans got to draw the maps, and they'll probably be in charge for a lot longer because of that. So that's one of Kay Hagan's biggest challenges. Black turnout in North Carolina in 2012 was 22% of the vote. If it's 22% of the vote again, Kay Hagan has a really good chance. If it drops down to 18 or 19% of the vote, Tom Tillis is going to have a really good chance because we're so racially polarized. Tom Tillis likely will win white voters in the state by 30, 35 points. Kay Hagan will win African-American voters by about 90 points. So the difference between 19% black turnout, 22% black turnouts, the difference between one candidate winning by two and the other candidate winning by two.
Tom, and do we also agree that the numbers for a third party or a libertarian candidate in July, say, are far higher than they will be at the actual voting booths in November?
I definitely agree with that. Right now, we're finding the libertarian Sean Haw at 11%. But I think what that's a reflection of is that we find that Kay Hagan has a negative approval rating. Tom Tillis has a negative favorability rating. So there's a lot of people who don't like either of these candidates. Right now, they're sort of parking with the libertarian. But by the time it gets to November, they'll end up making a lesser of two evils calculation. I don't like either of these candidates, but which of them do I dislike less? And what we're finding right now is that about 60% of those people saying they're voting for the libertarian are likely to move to Tom Tillis.
We're talking about measuring public opinion today on the state of things. Tom Jensen of Public Policy Polling and Jason Husser, assistant director of the Elon Poll, are with me, along with the political junkie Ken Rudin. Jason, so in measuring, again, sort of the art of polling, we have Moral Monday is underway. It's an effort to energize the progressive voting base. Is there a way to tell in advance through polling how effective that is in getting that margin from, say, 19 to 22% of African Americans or other progressive voters?
So you could ask a series of questions. You could ask things like, have you even heard of Moral Monday? We did that, and we found about two-thirds of folks had heard of it, but that still meant a third of the state still had not heard of it. You could then ask some sort of follow-up question, trying to gauge their enthusiasm for voting. The way we would do it would be a multi-pronged process.
Tom?
Yeah, it's interesting what we're finding about Moral Mondays is that it's actually a popular protest movement. In the past, when we've polled on Occupy Wall Street or polled on the Tea Party, those things will have upside-down favorability numbers. People say they don't like them. But Moral Monday, we find that about 50% of voters in the state see favorably, about 40% unfavorably. And one thing that's particularly interesting is when we ask people, who do you trust more, Moral Monday movement or the legislature, Moral Monday protesters went out big over the legislature on that front. So it will just be a key now to see how that finding sort of statewide can translate to the individual key legislative districts that Democrats need to pick up this fall in order to at least get the Republicans below a veto-proof majority in the House and Senate. I don't think many people think Democrats could get a majority in either of those houses, but there's definitely the potential to pick up some of those seats and get it below 60%.
On your next trust test, add Ken Rudin and see where he scores on this. Ken, I don't know if you had any last thoughts, but on the hunch that you don't.
Am I dying?
You and Lou Harris and the Keys together.
Careful,
now, one last
careful.
Question. I've got about 30 seconds, but how do you so the idea that Tom is finding in his polling Moral Monday is a popular protest movement, is there any way historically to tell whether that translates into political action?
Well, look at what's going on right now. A lot of people are talking about how the Republicans are pushing voter ID and shortening voting times, like early voting, around the country. Some people think that could help the Republican Party. Others say that could generate a backlash among African Americans and the minorities to get them out to vote. So you can see a lot of things going on from both ways. And, of course, the polling will let us know what's happening. I think the polling in North Carolina actually has been outstanding. If it wasn't for when I watched it in 2008, everybody was around the country was convinced that Elizabeth Dole was going to win a second term. But your polling showed that Kay Hagan was coming on strong, and they were right.
Real quick, have you done any polls? I mean, like 10 seconds, polls on voter ID legislation, how people feel about it?
Voter ID itself is popular, but the overall voting changes are not popular.
So we've been tracking voter ID a long time. At one point, all groups were had a majority support for voter ID. What we've seen is largely a result of Moral Monday is that while voter ID has a slight majority, it is no longer popular among Democrats and African Americans.
On the state of things, I want to thank you both. Jason Husser, Assistant Director of the Elon Poll. Thanks, Jason.
Thank you.
Ken Rudin, Political Junkie. Thank you, Ken.
Give my love to Lou.
All right. Tom Jensen, Public Policy Polling. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
Coming up, live music of Beauty World on the State of Things. Please stay with us.